Really brilliant. So thank you very much, Liz, for agreeing to record an interview with me today. I'd just like to start with your memories of community activism in Easter House, if that's all right.
Yeah, my involvement with this Easter House was very peripheral because I at that time was teaching and was aware of what was happening in Easter House through colleagues in Strathclyde Theatre Group, as it was then. We were all engaged with Hugo Gifford and exploring very experimental types of theatre practice, which was amazing. And people like Bill Marshall and others were developing those ideas in partnership with local people in Easter House. And, you know, was very aware that Easter House was growing in its stature and in its in a profile. And then it hit problems. It was starting to become what we would now recognise as an early community development trust. It had already made links with social enterprise activity in Spain and other European countries. It already got some European funding confirmed, and all it had to have was match. And there was talk of taking over the old Wool's factory to develop as a business centre for specifically local people who needed to find places to start up. Because there was absolutely nothing in Easter House at that time. There really was nothing. A friend and colleague, Rita Winters, she was doing a big mural project, which was, and we were beginning to understand the power of socially engaged cultural activity, and when people find their own voices through telling their stories in the likes of that mural, for example, and the power and the energy that created, and the ideas that spun off. Things like, you know, there was an awareness that Easter House was full of betting shops, and all the money went to Ladbrokes, and, you know, so the idea of why don't we have a betting shop that, yes, because people are going to bet, that is just what they're going to do, but if we have a betting shop that actually recycles the profits and puts them into community initiatives, and so there were all sorts of ideas that were bubbling under and were just about to take off. But social enterprise, community development trusts, that whole dialogue, it just didn't exist. So nobody knew what this was. Glasgow City Council was a very paternalistic, Labour councillor-dominated council. And saw it as some sort of threat. So basically Easter House Festival Society was killed off. And those of us who remained, Lisa Winters, Bill Marshall and others, we kind of came together, and I had also been involved at that time in another initiative in Paisley called Cartwheel, which was born out of, and again, so no understanding of either the power of culture or social enterprise, but purely entrepreneurially on the back of the Manpower Services Commission. We had established a theatre training initiative called Cartwheel, which was couched in the language of, you know, Manpower Services was designed for people learning to be electricians or chippies or, you know, brickies. So we couched it in those terms, managed to get lots of young people involved in making theatre. And yes, of course they were building sets and they were doing all sorts of electrics and all the other, but that really wasn't what the Manpower Services Commission idea had been. And this theatre company became you know, really powerful, and young people were having a voice and were touring around and winning awards, as was happening in Easterhouse. They were going to the Edinburgh Festival and getting accolades, and that really wasn't the idea. So Cartwheel was closed down as well. So the kind of rump of us, we, from both of those initiatives, we kind of, learning from that, decided, right, we'll make sure that we're never embedded in any one local authority ever again. We'll make sure that we're light on our feet and we're able to dance about and never be reliant on one political regime. We didn't know that that was starting to experiment with social enterprise, or we had no idea what we were doing. We were just responding to, and I think that's very much what I see looking back, that I had no idea I was a social entrepreneur until Senscot approached me and said, you know, will you join the board of Senscot because you're a social entrepreneur? I was like, what? What's that? So from there, we set up Fable Vision. Fable Vision originally was about making theatre and engaging particularly people with disabilities and people with either learning difficulties or a lot of people who were deaf, who didn't have a facility of language. We experimented with different ways of communicating, and from there we started to have residential programmes within specific communities where we were working in partnership with local people, getting local people supporting them, facilitating them to tell their own stories. We did a lot of work within social work originally in the early days, empowering people with disabilities who then eventually set up their own theatre company called Birds of Paradise. So we ended up having the first equity card carrying people with disabilities through Birds of Paradise. They are now winning prizes and have celebrated their own 25 years of existence. So really proud of that. Sort of the interim was working in social work, mental health services within communities in local authority areas, and finding packages of funding and putting together packages of funding for individual projects to just make sure that we got to do what we wanted to do. We didn't see ourselves as providing services, or we were responding to what we saw was a need, or if there was a threat to within a community to maybe a building or a local park, and people wanted to have their voices heard and make a difference and transform that. We were using creativity and cultural approaches. I didn't know at that time that that was cultural planning until we started work with going back, revisiting almost the Easterhouse area where we worked in Rucchese. That was for 1990 City of Culture. That was a really defining time for us because we, Strathclyde Region was approached by Glasgow City Council to be partners, funding partners in this City of Culture bid for 1990. And Strathclyde Region's priorities were very much social work and community development and those aspects, whereas the City Council was very much about profile and high culture and let's really put Glasgow on the map. And so there was a sort of clash of ideologies there, and Strathclyde Region had said, well, we will put some money in, but only if those agendas are included in the City of Culture bid. And that became an incredibly innovative approach that had never been done before. Previous City of Cultures had all been very much about high art and opera. So this was a completely new innovative initiative. And Strathclyde Region looked around to see who was there doing this sort of stuff, and the only people they could find were Projectability and Fable Vision. So all of a sudden, from scrambling around, responding to sort of whatever we could see and find it together in funding packages, suddenly we had this 3-year, I can't remember how much it was, but it was a lot of, in those days, you know, and in those terms, it was something like £200,000 over 3 years, which for us, you know, was a fortune. But of course we had to deliver all these enormous projects, one of which was Rucchese Rucchese, which built a theatre in Balcombe Street in Rucchese, and the whole community told its story in outdoor, large-scale puppets, and we had actors on the back of a lorry sort of performing on the tailbed. We had we built the Gorbals at one end of the street, and we blew that up and had everybody streaming out of the Gorbals, coming into this, what they saw as the, what they thought was going to be the new promised land, but of course it was just housing and nothing else. So, and the houses weren't very well built, and they were damp, and people got sick. And so we told the whole story, or rather local people told their own story, in this large-scale, high-profile production, which it still kind of lives on in the mythical memory in Rucchese. We also, during that period, launched Birds of Paradise as Birds of Paradise, and various other projects as well. So by 1993, we were exhausted. We were absolutely, and the money was not renewed. In fact, you know, it was a case of, right, you've had all that money, and now there's nothing in the coffers, so that's it then, you know. So once again, we were like, you know, how do we operate? How do we survive this? What's the economic answer? And we couldn't find one, and we were closing up shop, and we were literally had the receivers in when we received a phone call from Jean Hurstel in Strasbourg in France, and he and some of his colleagues were trying to set up a European network of artists and arts organisations who were working in this area of, they called it les banlieues, the marginalised areas, the excluded areas, because culture in Scotland and culture in France, they've both come from very different directions, but with similar results. The arts and culture in Scotland sort of developed from, there was the division between high arts and the rest. And high arts had all the funding and the money, and the rest was just, well, that it was all, it would all just kind of happen anyway, which, and it included activism, but again with no distinction in the landscape, because there were some aspects of that community type activity that were being funded, the likes of arts outreach from Scottish Opera or Scottish Ballet, or service provision like you know, sports and arts, you know, like workshops in community centres. They were being funded, but the kind of activism and really going for quality. I mean, we were even not really included in the community arts scene in Scotland at that time, because the community arts scene very much prioritised the politics and the polemic, and the quality really wasn't of particular interest. And we were convinced that it was both, that, you know, if you're respecting a community and a people, then quality in the art is every bit as important as the message and the process and the engagement. So we were really quite isolated in our approach. Plus we had the whole kind of Labour Party agenda of paternalism, and coupled with, but let's build a concert hall and make a big splash, and, you know, so there was that kind of whole cultural idea going on, which very much came from the Labour Party. Whereas in France, the whole sort of cultural movement had come from academia, really, and the whole sort of the Jean Oursels and the folks who were doing the kind of work we were engaged with in Scotland, they had come through a kind of much more academic route. So at first we had said, no, we're not going, we're closing up shop, and then say, oh, they insisted they would pay for it, and everything would be covered, and they had to hear about what we were doing because it was so terribly important. So we went, and I mean, I just spent the whole 3 days in tears in this auditorium. You know, it was like, oh my God, there's other people in the world, because we didn't even at that time have much relationship with what was happening in England or any of the other parts of the UK. We were very much isolated. Mm-hmm. So that was to me, that was the turning point in my journey, was meeting not only other practitioners who were doing it, but also were thinking about it and talking and writing and distinguishing the landscape and discovering why, because when you're in it, you're feeling, it's something I'm doing wrong. We're not getting anywhere here. It must be because we're not doing it right. And to actually be able to realise, no, there are folks all over Europe who are doing the same, experiencing the same things and coming up against the same barriers. It's political. It's not personal. And realising that was kind of the turning point for me personally in my journey. So I came back here enthused about networks and started setting up both local networks and a national network called the Arts and Communities Artists and Communities Association in Scotland. And Sheena Wellington was a key driver in that as well. And we started having these dialogues and making these distinctions, and eventually had, in the year 2000, the Banlieue d'Europe network conference came to Glasgow. We had that in the tramway, and we sort of talked through these distinctions, talked about the Scottish experience. And I suppose, I don't think it's possible to underestimate the role that that whole movement played in moving activism and that sort of cultural planning approach into a more accepted mainstream. Actually surviving it continued to be the biggest challenge. Surviving it financially continued to be the biggest challenge, because there wasn't any funding for that kind of activity. And various groups were experimenting in different ways. The way Fablevision tried to do it was by setting up a trading arm, Fablevision Studios. The idea being that people who are long-term unemployed, learning the skills, because we were doing that anyway on all the projects. We had folks long-term unemployed all coming and learning and having their lives sort of turned around through being engaged and being creative and learning new skills and interacting. And so it seemed an obvious thing to set up a trading arm that would be long-term unemployed people engaged in those activities of making films, making publications, event management, because every project we did needed a film, needed a publication, needed event management, needed social media, needed, although it's all that web and social media. I mean, when I started out, it was on an Amstrad typewriter, you know, so the whole thing has just changed so fundamentally in my lifetime. I'm very, very old. Yeah, so we set up Fablevision Studios as a trading arm, and so that the charity Fablevision could continue to just respond and engage with artists and local community groups of whatever persuasion or kind, and create whatever was needed as an intervention. Whether that was in things to do with poverty, public space development, saving an artefact or a building, heritage, you know, whatever the area was that we wanted to intervene, we were free to do that. And the studios then providing the services to the charity. So we were putting together funding packages as the charity, employing the studios to deliver the support work for the charity projects, and the studios were also bidding for contracts for local authorities, mainly other social enterprises actually, and that was when the whole sort of GSEN development has been very, very important. And anyway, I'm jumping forward. So setting up Fablevision Studios and then being invited onto the board of, I can't remember whether I was invited onto the board or just coming to a conference, because I'm, you know, recognised as a social entrepreneur, and I hadn't even heard that term before. So that was another big turning point for me in my understanding of what was going on, was finding Senscot, joining Senscot, and
roughly what kind of year would that have been?
When was Senscot established?
2001.
Was that'll it? Be it then.
Between 1999 and 2001.
Well, I think I was in year two, because the Lawrence and Aidan were already there. So was Liz Thomas. I think she was on the board at that time. So I think it certainly wasn't the very first year. It was maybe year two or three.
Yeah.
When I started to get distinctions around social enterprise, community development trusts, and realised that an awful lot of what I had been trying to do over the years was establish community development. For example, in Royston Road, we worked in Royston Road between 1999 and 2003 with Russell McClarty, who was the local minister, and he was straddling two communities, the Black Hill Problem Mill community and the Royston Hill community, and each They were traditionally competing with each other for tiny wee pots of local authority funding. So his idea was, well, why don't we join together and actually try and do something really major? And what we realised was that Townhead Church on Royston Hill was under threat. In fact, it was being demolished. But the spire was an iconic landmark. So we worked with the local folk to try and save that spire. First of all, to save the church, but we failed, and then just to save the spire. And we managed to stop the demolition of the spire. So gradually we started to, through a series of artist residencies and initiatives, to envision a community space with the spire at the centre of it, coupled with an equally iconic community space around the Molendiner Burn and Waterfall, was where St Mungo apparently first woke up in Glasgow, and the Molendiner Burn runs under the Glasgow Cathedral, and the source of it is at Molendiner. So it's an iconic historic place. So we did do that, and that was a sort of whole 3-year process of establishing Royston Road Project as a community development organisation. But fatally, councillors got involved. And I mean, we were going all across Europe telling this story with local people. Telling their story, it was praised. It was winning awards. It won the Surf Award. It won the Borough Award, which is the British Urban Regeneration Award. It won various accolades, and councils got involved. And the next stages. The next stages of the plans for the Royston Road project had been to establish a trading arm which would deliver environmental improvements and involve unemployed folk. And we wanted to take over a space to develop workshop and start-up business spaces in the school that was closing down. But councillors got involved, and David Harding, the wonderful, he had been heading up public art in Glasgow School of Art for years and years. He is an iconic figure, world famous for all sorts of innovative practice. He was the chair by that time. And the local authority decided to do it themselves, basically. So we've never quite got to the bottom of how to protect, I suppose, keep those very precious initiatives alive in the face of that kind of hostility and takeover. I mean, those are very, very painful experiences, and sometimes the fatal flaws are internal, not just external, because, you know, community organisations within communities used to poverty and scarcity, when there's suddenly some money there, they all start to fall apart, compete for the money, and you know, there are so many layers upon layers of it's not ideologically naivety was my kind of approach. I thought, you know, all you had to do was set up a community organisation, it would all be well. But you know, the experience has taught me that it's not just external factors that are the enemy. It's very often internal stuff as well. So where are we now? That was 2003, introduced to SenseScot. That was another sort of turn in the road and a realisation that these structures and you know, that basically I had been the source of setting up various social enterprises over the years. Some of them had been successful and had survived, others hadn't. What was very interesting was looking back over the whole banlieue d'Europe experience and realising that many of the founding organisations and artists from that period, academics, artists, their organisations were still in existence, like Fable Vision was still there, Voc Enclosure, you know, various ones that had been the original founding members were still there, whereas so many organisations had been and gone. So there was obviously something very powerful in networking and being part of both a local, national, SenseScot type organisation and the international network. And Scotland has really pioneered the development of the landscape. You know, SenseScot launched the Development Trust Association. SenseScot launched the Academy. Also Firstport to give startup organisations. A whole series of networks, both locally based and thematically based. So there is a cultural social enterprise network, and there are you know, various themed social enterprise networks as well as locally based ones. The locally based ones, some of them have been hugely successful, like GSEN, and provide huge amounts of intertrading. I mean, most of Fable Vision Studios business that isn't the charity commissions comes through GSEN. There has been a big debate in the cultural social enterprise scene because I have always maintained that the enterprise should never come out of the art, if you like, that needs to be a separate thing, because if you try and make the enterprise the art, then you're diluting what you're doing. And it's still an interesting debate, and it's still an ongoing debate. And I think none of these debates have really gone away. They're all still there, and still being. We're still ever more rigorously distinguishing what we're all doing. So, you know, there's cultural regeneration, which is a whole area. There's the regeneration of culture, which is a whole other area. There's cultural planning, which is where I see where we have been involved. There's cultural development, arts and cultural development, which is what Glasgow City Council funds primarily. And, you know, I think until we get real distinction around what is the difference between cultural planning and arts and cultural development, there won't really be easy access for the Govan Hill Bath Trust or the Govan Docks Regeneration Trust or any of these organisations that are trying to take a cultural and creative approach to regeneration, because there isn't the partnership and the funding and the resourcing there to allow those distinctions to flourish. Glasgow City Council sees arts development as, you know, you look at the landscape and you see where there isn't theatre or there isn't art or there isn't music, and you put it in. Whereas the perspective, the cultural planning perspective, is about let's work with a community, let's help that community identify what is, celebrate it, nurture it, develop it. So it's like it's two sides, and we haven't really had those debates properly as to what we're trying to achieve and what is the best methodology for achieving it. Leith Walk, there's another example of an emerging cultural social enterprise, cultural, you know, development trust, and it certainly seems to be that there is something really, really powerful happens when artists work together with communities or the artists are the community and the artists are also the activists, or something really powerful happens when that combination is present. But at the moment there's no real place for it. It's still regarded as an irritant, and I know there are initiatives now to develop networks of community activists so that we can all learn from each other and look at these, because these examples are very, very powerful examples of community activism. The Stove Network in Dumfries is another one. Governor Bath Trust. But it's the creativity, it's the underpinning cultural planning approach to my mind, that is so powerful. But we haven't really quite teased that out yet fully.
That's been a great insight into how your work has developed over the years. Could I just kind of backtrack a wee bit and kind of expand on a few areas? You mentioned right at the beginning that you were actually teaching when you became part of the Easter House Festival Society. When did you make the leap to kind of stop teaching and start, the community activism and the community planning? When did that distinction happen for you personally?
When I had my children, took maternity leave, and I had been feeling more and more trapped into. I loved the teaching and I loved working with the young people and also out in the wider community, but always felt trapped in that system.
Mm. Was it primary school children?
No, secondary.
High school. Mm. And what did you teach?
Drama, theatre studies, okay. and English up to higher level. And I always felt, you know, trapped and not able to sort of fulfil full potential within the education system. So when I was on maternity leave, I started working with the Cartwheel folk and set up, first of all, freelance workshops, and then got together with the team that formed Fable Vision.
And who was part of that team, that initial team?
Bill Marshall, who had come from Easter House, and Rita Winters, who had come from Easter House, Bert Scott, who had come from Cartwheel, and Ian Carmichael, who had come from Cartwheel, and myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And were they all from similar backgrounds, teaching backgrounds?
Yeah, we were. No, not necessarily. We all had links to Strathclyde Theatre Group with Hugo Gifford, who was a great inspiration, who died very young, sadly. And Hugo had been experimenting with all sorts of very innovative theatre practices that were Augusta Boal, that were all about improvisation, were all about exploring character and working with communities, and creating huge pageants, which the Golden City was one, which went to the Edinburgh Festival and won huge awards. So that was an inspiration, that whole kind of very rich experimental place when we were students, young and forming our ideas, and then we all kind of went off and did, and then came back around, mm-hmm. having learned that it wasn't going to be as easy as we had imagined.
Mm. Yeah. And so were you on like the board of the Easter House Festival?
No.
What was your involvement?
No, my involvement was just with a few workshops and being involved with basically, by the time I had started to get involved, it was the end of the society. It was being destroyed. Mm. It was being ravaged in the press, and it was being ravaged by local politicians. So I had no formal involvement at all, okay. But learned a huge amount from being around the guys who are going through it.
And what were the types of criticisms being levelled at the society?
Oh, the artists were on the make and had offshore bank accounts with yachts, and Bill Marshall apparently owned an island. And I mean, just ludicrous. I don't think there was no ability to understand why any human being would pour themselves into something with such passion and commitment that, you know, their whole lives became that thing, unless there was some money in it. No, there was no distinction about altruism and just being so driven to create, and also to make a difference in a community where there was clearly a difference desperately needing to be made. Mm. There was no understanding of why would somebody or a team of people devote their lives to that? If there was no financial, there must be something. Mm. So the suspicion and the gossip started. Also, there were sort of, as Easter House got more successful, on the one hand, it was, it was winning accolades in the Edinburgh Festival. It was hugely. Frankie Vaughan was. There were celebrities taking an interest in it, and it had attracted European funding, which was, that was absolutely unheard of for a community organisation. So the other community organisations were jealous. Mm. There was a culture, and this is still the case. The politics of poverty, where people are used to such tiny resources that when success happens, they all squabble and internally destroy it. Or if one organisation is seen to be suddenly successful and the others aren't, they'll turn on it. Mm. And that was what was happening. Plus the politicians who felt threatened, I suppose. They weren't able to be paternally acknowledged for this largesse, because they hadn't given any largesse. The Easter House team had done it themselves, so the politicians weren't able to sort of, so they felt redundant, and therefore the only thing to do is destroy it. Mm-hmm. Is how I interpret what went on, because it was just, and then once those stories about, oh, he's got an offshore bank account and she's got a, and he owns an island, and they're filtering up, there's all these hundreds of thousands of pounds coming into Easter House, where's it all going? So once that suspicion starts and it's almost inevitable. I don't think that happens so much now, because I think there are there is a better understanding now through the work of Senscott and all the other networks in the landscape and the learning that we have now. But it was so innovative and it was so in advance of its time. And what's very interesting to me is that the role of the artists has been written out of that story over the years. When I now read about Easter House Festival Society in other academic journals and publications, it's talked about as a local community who just sort of spontaneously decided to set up Easter House Festival Society. So there's still no real distinction of that facilitation role and the role of the artists in inspiring what happened there. And Craig Miller's a bit like that as well. Craig Miller was, Easter House and Craig Miller were very interesting sort of twins, because Easter House developed very much from interventionist artist perspective. Craig Miller developed more from the sort of thinkers and the academics, but with the artists as well. So Craig Miller actually has documented a lot, much more than Easter House has. Easter House was just doing it. But Craig Miller actually documented it, mm-hmm. as it went. I don't know if you've spoken to Andrew Crummy. Mm.
know, but I've read his mum's book, yeah. The Wee Yellow Butterfly.
Yeah.
And I was...
Let the People Sing was her first one.
Uh-huh. Or, yes, yeah, sorry, I'm confusing it. Wee Yellow Butterfly is about Easter House, and Let the People Sing is about Craig Miller.
Yes.
I have got both. And yeah, I was wondering, at the time, was there much dialogue between...
No, that's what I was saying about recognising the role of networks later on, mm-hmm. when I discovered Banlieue de Rot and discovered... To be fair, Chris Affleck and others in Easter House had realised the power of networking. They had been involved with the Mondragon social enterprise in Spain, and they had already realised the power of looking to other examples and learning and bringing that learning back. From a personal point of view, it was really only from the Banlieue de Rot experience that I really got it. So it's that difference between knowing something and then getting it, you know, is huge. You can learn something intellectually, but it's only when you actually experience it that you really get it. And for me, that it was that 1993 sitting in the Banlieue de Rot network, listening to others and hearing my own experience echoed, which was so overwhelming, personally. Yeah. But others had before me realised that it was important. But no, we didn't do much networking until the Arts and Communities Association, and the networking that we did do, we spent an awful lot of time fighting with each other. There was a community arts network in Glasgow just around about the time of Easter House, and then up to the 1990s. But as I say, there were ideological divisions that, because we had never distinguished and talked about it, we saw those ideological divisions as, you know, one was bad and wrong, and the other one was the only way to be, you know, and so we spent an awful lot of time fighting with each other rather than understanding the role of each, the distinction and the diverse role of each, and how it's all that diversity coming together that makes it work. We weren't mature enough or able to see that at that time. Mm-hmm. So we just fought, and there were factions, and those factions still exist, but again, because there has been more dialogue, there is a lot more understanding now, and again, I think SendScot and the organisations that SendScot has supported into being have had a huge role to play in those distinctions.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of spaces are required for those dialogues to happen? Is it, you know, as you've mentioned, the kind of the different structures of SendScot, or is it conferences? What, you know, if you were planning part of the social enterprise strategy today, and I think again there's...
Well, I've just completed the census. I've just literally yesterday completed that census, and I just kept saying networks, and let the networks develop their own responses. And support them in the developing of their own responses. Because the networks coming together, they know what they need, and they start to recognise what's needed and can be supported into delivering that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what we're planning now is to have a coming together. Well, it was supposed to be a coming together of Saint Scott, Social Firm Scotland, and Social Enterprise Scotland, but Social Enterprise Scotland are probably going to be going their own way, and it will be a coming together of Saint Scott and Social Firm Scotland. I hope the government understands why what Social Enterprise Scotland is proposing is not acceptable to us. Because what Social Enterprise Scotland is proposing is to allow in organisations that are not code compliant or are not going to abide by the asset lock. And those of us in this dialogue are, you know, clear that the asset lock is the key. As soon as there is personal profits and shares, and it's a completely different animal. And we feel that we are being labelled as sort of dyed in the wool or old-fashioned or something. So we need to have these distinctions very clearly discussed now. This is a very important time for these distinctions to be clearly articulated, because it's if there is an acceptance that the asset lock is not paramount, then we will just be diluted. And this is what has happened over my lifetime. You know, initiatives start up and are hugely important and sound and have integrity. The community arts movement of the 1960s, for example, was activism, was committed artists with a mission to make a difference in the world. That then became diluted with local authority speak, and it lost its power, it lost its teeth, and it just became service delivery. And those of us who were the activists and the in that community arts movement were marginalised, and we had to then find. You know, it's been from my journey has been years of ducking and diving and finding, like water. You know, you get the block comes up. So how do you find your way around that? So community arts movement became diluted. In the 1990s, my passion was cultural planning, and I realised that I was a cultural planner. That was what I was actually practising, was working with communities to identify their resources in their history or their heritage or their landscape or their buildings or their people, their culture, their myths and legends. And helping them to celebrate those. I was a cultural planner. I am a cultural planner. And, you know, it was very much... I could see clearly that was the methodology. That was what Patrick Geddes purported in, you know, the early part of the late 19th century, early 20th century. And I could see what cultural planning was. And then that became diluted, and we started to get cultural regeneration described as cultural planning. You know, just let's build a big building and have arts happening in it, and that will be cultural planning. And so the cultural planning agenda got diluted and taken off track, and stuff was being described as cultural planning, which to my mind wasn't cultural planning at all. So I'm now trying to get distinctions around all that. The same thing has happened with the social enterprise movement. We started in the late 1990s, early 2000s, with a really clear vision of what social enterprise is. And, you know, we do now have a code which is very clear. A social enterprise has a board of volunteers who are not shareholders. Any profits are reinvested in the social aims. Very clear. And then somehow over the years, that has been hijacked or diluted, or and now we have social businesses calling themselves social enterprises that are really just businesses with a social purpose. Nothing wrong with them. There's nothing wrong with any of it. Of course we need social businesses with a social purpose. Of course we do. And of course, you know, cultural buildings are very important. But we need to be clear about what they are and where the distinctions are and what they're going to deliver and what they're going to achieve. I mean, if we set up social businesses with shareholders who can have return on investments, we can't expect to deliver a society of equality. And we need to know what we're going to deliver by going down whatever route we go down. And I think that's the biggest challenge now, is because all of these, the community arts movement, there's still so much there that could be made happen brilliantly. Cultural planning, we can still make it happen brilliantly. Social enterprise, brilliantly. But we need to A, understand what we're talking about and be sharing a language, and B, we need to have others sharing the same page and supporting the networks that are delivering the initiatives. We need cross-sectoral working together with understanding of what we're actually doing, instead of bandying words about that are actually not what we're meaning.
Mm-hmm. So can you see two distinct kind of networks and support mechanisms developing, you know, for these different activities, you know, one for social enterprises with an asset lock and one with enterprises that have a social purpose but will work more closely with the private sector? Do you think there's going to be a kind of split?
Well, I think there is a split, and the problem at the moment is that we're trying to pretend there isn't. Mm-hmm. And I think until we are really, really clear, and it's we who need to be really, really clear, not the ones who are ignoring the asset lock, because I mean, there are support mechanisms for those organisations. Those businesses are there's Business Gateway, there's Scottish Enterprise, there's all sorts of support for that type of activity. We need to make sure that we protect the support for the code compliant, the asset locked organisations, or they will disappear. They will just be annihilated. Because they can't compete, they cannot possibly compete against what basically is traditional capitalism, traditional business. You know, it's just not comparable or compatible. And if we try and pretend that they are the same, we will lose our social enterprise movement, which has been so innovative and world-renowned.
I was thinking about how you were talking about, you know, being kind of water, making your way around these different kind of phases of dilution across your work, and I've talked about, you know, how you would put packages of funding together at certain points, you know, before the City of Culture funding, and, you know, for a period afterwards, whatever. I've heard similar stories from other practitioners that is just immensely stressful and exhausting, and that can be a real barrier to sustainability, because just the kind of the piecemeal and the constant kind of funding cycle is just exhausting, even if you can have enough money together to continue.
It's totally unsustainable. And that was where the idea for the Fable Vision Studios came from, was to try and find a way of breaking that deadlock of constantly finding, trying to put funding packages together. The idea was that the Fable Vision Studios would have a constant stream of commercial contracts that would then feed the charity, and the charity would then be able to pay the bills in the meantime while it put together the next fragile funding package for by, with and for the next community organisation. I would love to say it's been a huge success. but we've just bumped along the bottom. I mean, we're still here, but I can't say that it's been hugely successful. It probably would have been in somebody else's hands, but you know, I think there are very different skills required for that kind of entrepreneurial, responsive, interventionist approach. And that's what I am naturally. I am naturally that. I'm not naturally a manager of a social enterprise that is, you know, basically just marketing, selling and bringing in contracts. And you know, we've had various managers over the years who have been that, and, you know, who have developed it reasonably well. But I'm sure if there had been equal passion into both, there would have been more successful sustainability.
Yeah. But it remains a difficult thing to balance, with the structures.
Impossible,
that you've,
actually.
Tried to put in place.
Yeah, absolutely impossible. Totally impossible. Yeah, 35 years on, I can say unequivocally, it is impossible.
And so, what keeps you going? What keeps you doing the impossible?
What else would I do if I didn't do what I want to do and respond when there's something needing to be done? I don't know what else I would do.
My last question I want to return to, you know, you talked about how your work is about letting people tell their stories, and you gave a lovely few examples of those stories. And I'm thinking, over the 35 years, have the types of voices, have the types of stories, have they changed? Or has there been a bit of continuity through this?
I don't know if the stories have changed, or if if I have changed in my, I mean, what I'm engaged in primarily currently is a European transnational project with six cities. It's called Memory of Water, and what we're doing is we're looking at post-industrial waterfront heritage zones. So my focus is Govan's Graving Docks, and we've got partners in Stockholm in Sweden, Gothenburg, Ostend, Limerick in Ireland, Levadia in Greece, and particularly Gdansk in Poland, who we've actually been working with now for 5 or 6 years, because there's so many resonances between Govan and Gdansk, both rooted in activism, Gdansk with Lech Walesa and us with Jimmy Reid, both have written the women's voices out of the story. You know, we suspected that, you know, these things probably didn't happen just with these heroic men, and so it has proved. You know, we have discovered that actually it was the women who were running it, and these heroic men were kind of anyway, finding those stories, finding those histories, and telling the stories again from the women's perspective, that's all been really exciting. What I've been trying to do is really focus on, well, what is it that is missing between the artistic interventionism and the actual delivery of planning outcomes on the ground? Because Govan Graving Docks was earmarked by the owners and developers. The owners are also house builders, to have 750 high-rise flats, and these are iconic, A-listed, you know, the last of their kind, certainly in the UK. And there had been a series of artistic interventions, some through Fable Vision, previous ones. You know, it's been a magnet for artists over the years. And so what actually needs to happen to make that leap between the activism and the interventionism and the actual changing planning outcomes on the ground? And you know, again, it's actually impossible. however, you know, we're doing it. I suppose the realization of the reality of capitalism for me has been huge. I was very, very naive, and thought that, you know, we could actually set up a Govan Docks Regeneration Trust, which we've done, that would be able to take ownership of the docks, and worked with activist Ian McGilvery for about 10 years now, to create a new dialogue around. So his activism was quite traditional and confrontational and direct, and what we've brought into the mix is that symbolic and much more questioning, creative approach, involving local people and a whole sort of consultation process, artistic interventionism that creates a new seeing of the docks locally, so that local people see the treasure that they have in their midst. And this is happening all in these six cities all over Europe, with exactly the same problems and issues. I think the one that's closest to us is Gdansk. Both Govan and Gdansk, we've now won some victories. We've both been following very similar paths with both activism and artistic interventionism. We've both, Gdansk managed to save their cranes, so the cranes now have a historic order on them, so they can't be demolished. Govan, we lost our cranes in Govan, but we have managed to put a stop on the 750 homes. So now it's like, well, what's next and what's needed to actually take these things forward in both Govan and Gdansk? And I can't remember what the question was now.
Just about stories and continuity and change. In
yeah, what's the change of the story? Right, so the story hasn't really changed, but I suppose what I was trying to say was that my reaction has changed, and that I'm much more so my approach now is about, okay, here's this huge problem, rather than just taking one approach, let's involve dialogue, let's involve six cities, European cities, let's involve the local councillors and politicians and the national councillors and politicians. So we've now got a conference and exhibition that will happen in the Scottish Parliament in June that will involve MSPs and all the partners from all the six cities. There's also an installation in the Scottish Parliament which is about me and the Govan Graving Docks, and that's a permanent installation. This exhibition in June will be temporary. But trying to be more strategic in the approach, rather than assuming that all that's needed is something gorgeous to happen and everybody will understand that we can't possibly build high-rise flats on the Govan Graving Docks, which is where I think I was 20 odd years ago, but sort of understanding that, no, that's not enough. You know, it's not enough just to create the gorgeousness, and we actually have to have structures and strategy in place to, and all these dialogues need to happen, not just about the Graving Docks, not just about cultural regeneration, but also all the dialogues about social enterprise, and it all has to happen together. Sometimes I feel, you know, that the way my life has gone is, I started out thinking, I just want to make a difference with this wee thing, and that will change everything. And then, well, actually, I've got to make a difference here first before I can make a difference with this wee thing. And then, well, actually, I've got to make a difference here before I can make a difference there, so that I can make a difference with this wee thing. And then, well, no, actually, I've got to make a difference here before I can make a difference here, before I can make a difference here, before I can make a difference with that wee thing. And it's like that. It's like those dolls, those Russian dolls. And now I'm too old to really do it. You know? Too late. It's Does that make sense?
It makes absolute sense. And I by no means think it's too late. I think sharing that understanding is a really great thing to do. And we just can hope some people will listen.
Well, I'm now doing this PhD again in the hope that I can make the difference here, that will make the difference here. And you know, the PhD, the idea of that is to try and get the clarity of distinctions and confidence with the distinctions myself, so that I can talk more powerfully and clearly about the distinctions and what I see from my own personal perspective and my own experience on that journey to try and spread some understanding.
Great. I think that's a good place to finish, unless there's anything else you think we need to cover. Okay, great. I'll stop the recording there, and I look forward to reading the PhD.